What's up? You're listening to Soft Difference, a podcast of Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. On this pod, you'll hear from Giorgio, Eric, and myself, Justin, talk about 1 Peter and how 1 Peter calls us to love Jesus and love others in the world. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Soft Difference podcast. I'm Justin. Solo hosting today with no co-host, but I'm glad to be here with you all. This podcast is like a little bit of an after-hours podcast where we talk about the sermon from Sunday and have some discussion about it. But today, we're going to take a little different turn because we have a special guest. Her name is Sarah Wright, and Sarah has written a book on 1 Peter called A Living Hope. And she is a scholar, a teacher of religious studies, and an excellent theologian in her own right. And so we're glad to have you here, Sarah. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So Sarah and I have an interesting story. First, why don't you, before I say that interesting story, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're up to now? A little bit of your family, just some brief background.
Goodness, all the things. Let's see. I am the wife to Lee, who is a campus minister with RUF. We've been in RUF for 11 or 12 years. I'm losing track at this point.
Long time.
It goes by quickly. We were at the University of Central Florida for a while. Now we are at the University of Texas in San Antonio. I'm currently a middle school religion teacher at TMI Episcopal. I'm still trying to write, but grading papers and making lesson plans are taking up quite a bit of my time. Lee and I have three kids, also taking up quite a bit of my time. Tilly, Margo, Max. Tilly is a seventh grader here at TMI Episcopal, and Margo's a fifth grader. And Max is a third grader. And so on the weekends, we are doing all the sports and all the activities and all of the parenting things, which is busy and fun and tiring and wonderful. I'd like to keep writing. And I think eventually something else will come out. I thought that I'd have something out after A Living Hope, and life keeps taking unexpected turns. One of the biggest ones being COVID. I have A Living Hope right here. So I wrote A Living Hope, and it was intended to be either a devotional or a community Bible study. And I finished it end of December in 2019, and our publish date was set for early April of 2020. And of course, the pandemic hit of March of 2020. And so things took a turn with that one. But I love it, and I'm proud of it, and I'm thankful for it. Thankful that God gave me the opportunity to write it. So hopefully something else, something soon will come down the pipeline. I've just got to find time.
Yeah, that's right. That's exciting. So Sarah and I first, we met because we both worked for an organization called Docent. And this was probably over 10 years ago, 11 years ago, probably 12 years ago, maybe more.
Somewhere in there. Yeah,
so Docent does research, and Sarah is a researcher. I am not. I am just a guy who talks to people. And so I acted as the go-between between the clients and the researcher. And so mine was customer relations, and Sarah's was all the hard, dirty work. And she was what I discovered very early on about Sarah is she is incredibly thorough and thoughtful, which are two things that don't always go together. And she did both of those things incredibly well. She thought, like a pastor would think, and was very helpful in the research that she gave to pastors. So I'm really glad that you're here. What made you decide to do your kind of first seminal study on 1 Peter?
Oh, long story less long, it started as a Bible study when I was an REF intern.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted a practical book to talk to college girls about. And I heard that First Peter was practical. I liked Peter as a character. I found him very relatable.
Mm-hmm.
I love Paul, don't get me wrong. And I know we're not supposed to like favorites, but Paul has one encounter with Jesus and he becomes the most prolific author of the New Testament.
Right.
And that's awesome, but I can't really relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, not to read my culture as an Italian on Peter, but Peter is so relatable to me because he's like, oh, Jesus, I would never betray you. Forget about it. And then like the next thing you know, some slave girl with no standing, no voice in society whatsoever is like, hey, weren't you one of Jesus's friends? And he's like, oh, Jesus, I don't know the guy. Uh-uh, not me. And the way that he goes up and down and the way that he's hot and cold and the way that he falters and the way that God keeps bringing him back, I found so relatable and so refreshing as a person who is real and raw and human in this world. I feel like it speaks to the Christian walk
mm-hmm.
so deeply and so honestly. And so Peter very early appealed to me as a person who could very honestly speak, like the way that an older uncle could, mm-hmm. about what it is to live the Christian life in a meaningful way as someone who had had these massive triumphs and also massive failures, and who had been brought back by Jesus and redeemed by Jesus and was steadying the course, not because of his own effort, but because of God's mercy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. We did this book largely because in the spring we did Encounters with Jesus and John, and several of those last bits centered on Peter and his story. And I felt like it flowed really well because of that, but also because of where we're at currently in 2025 in America. And wanted to kind of like attack some of the themes and ethics that the gospel is to produce in the church. And so when you think about that, the big idea of that, what are some of those, what do you think Peter's trying, how do you think Peter's trying to form this church and consequently us? Like, if you think about this as a formational book, gospel to ethics, doctrine to life. Like, what do you think Peter's trying to, how do you think he's trying to form us?
Oh, I love that question. I love that question. I think Peter is speaking to a real audience in the midst of struggle. I think their political situation is also incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm.
Nero's pressing on them, right? He's mm-hmm. making their life exceptionally difficult, and the easiest thing to do would be to cater to Nero in order to not suffer. But instead they have a higher calling than that, and they're supposed to live holy lives, so much so that people outside of the faith would see them and say, hey, what's different about them? Why are they different? In walking in that holiness, they are to be different in every way: how they treat their servants, how they treat their spouses, how they handle their businesses and their money. And even if they are to suffer, which is almost a likelihood, even if they are to suffer for the sake of the gospel, there is a blessing in that because they are serving God and following in Christ's holiness and in his pattern of suffering for the will of God.
Mm-hmm.
I think standing out in that way is essential because caving to societal norms and pressures is not something that Christians are supposed to do or meant to do when the calling for us is higher than that and more meaningful than that.
Yeah. Okay. So, and I love that. That was excellent. How does Peter want them to do that? And yeah, so, and then like take it to our level for us in your mind, how does Peter want them to do that? And then how does How should we then internalize that message that Peter's saying?
That's a good question. There are various groups that he addresses, right? Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that I love the most about Peter is that he addresses the servants of the household. And in doing so, there's this major flip in society where instead of addressing the patriarch, like the head male of the household, he addresses the servant and gives honor and dignity to a member of society that is habitually marginalized. I think that that in and of itself is a precedent for us to be looking around and finding the dignity in people that are otherwise not seen as dignified.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it speaks to the fact that, number one, we all have something to give in this leadership aspect as far as living these holy lives. We're not meant to cut corners. We're not meant to oppress each other. We're not meant to slander or to do crooked things for our own self-interest or self-gain. In fact, we're meant to lay our lives down in the way that Jesus laid his life down. We're meant to be shepherds. We're meant to use our gifts of stewardship for each other and to be so ready to serve each other that it's almost spring-loaded in its tension, right? I'm to be so ready to serve you that it's almost like a launching at you with a heart that's longing to serve you.
Mm-hmm.
I think today we see a lot of tending to me and mine first. And I think that that's antithetical to the gospel and Christ's message, where we're supposed to view others, and in particular, the marginalized, as a group worthy of care and welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, particularly so those on the outside, right? Like the outside,
right.
Whatever our social structures are, certainly we could think about those social structures from a, you know, church perspective, American church, American evangelical church, whether we want to use that term or not at the moment. But even as Reformed churches, like, okay, so what does it look like for those who is the outside of us, who even are a part of us that feel like they're on the outside? And how do we both spring towards them in love, actions for their good, sacrificial love, as well as elevate them to these positions that are normally reserved for insiders, right? And that can be really difficult in the church. It's difficult even in your like family systems and structures to do that. And so Peter really subversively challenges kind of how we think about things. What about how should the gospel? So Peter, you know, says we've been born again into this living hope, and then he kind of throws the weight of the resurrection around, which is like, you know, Peter's kind of deal, having, you know, been a unique witness to Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. He throws the resurrection around as like the power by which we do this. So let's make this a little bit more personal. So for you, Sarah, how does the gospel, living hope, and the resurrection animate you to do this? Because I think that's what Peter's ultimately getting at, right? Mm-hmm. That the engine for the church is that you've been born again into this living hope that's results in resurrection, a grace that comes future, but a grace born from the past. And because you know it's past and future, you know it's with you in the present, even right, as you suffer for him.
Right. Right. There's so much to it. There's past, present, future. There's the Father's participation, the Son's participation, the Holy Spirit's participation. There's the power, right? The dunamis, right? The dynamite aspect of it, if you will. Oh, that's such a good question. Because if I'm being fully honest with you,
yeah,
sometimes it doesn't have the power and the impact in my life that it should. Because again, I forget and I need to remember the hope that I have, right? Because if I lose sight of that power, and if I go back to my own power, which is so puny and minuscule in comparison, that's when I focus on my own efforts, or really my shortcomings, or the ways that I fail. And then it doesn't feel also powerful. It just kind of feels like, oh, trudging, right? Mm. And just going along. No, I think that there's a renewal aspect of it. I think there's a gentleness to it as well as a power to it, right? It's the mercies are new every morning kind of aspect, right? It's the waking up and realizing that Resurrection Sunday has happened, mm-hmm. and the beauty of that, the thanksgiving in that, the gratitude in that, right? And that's a subtle beauty, but it's also a powerful, true reality. Right. It is the fact that sin does not have to hold you anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's the fact that you can go a different way than the way that you walked before. I can confess to the Lord and even to those safe people around me, the things that I'm struggling with. I can give over former passions and lusts and desires that are not meant to be my all. I can put away old desires and seek new ones. I can, you know, whatever it takes to pursue that holiness, I can put away those things, or I can give away those things, not because I am powerful, but because I have a power within me given to me by the Holy Spirit because of the resurrection of Christ. I'm enabled to do those things in a way that I had not been able to do before. And when I forget, I have the kindness of Christ reminding me and calling me back to walk in that pathway again, right? Walk in those footsteps again, walk in that light again. Yeah, it is a beautiful thing and it is a powerful thing.
So I think
to remember it all the time. Yeah,
for sure. I think like what you and Lee are trying to do at UTSA, on the campus of UTSA, is very much like a case study of walking this out. So you all moved to San Antonio, took over this campus. I mean, y'all started this, right? You started the work?
It was kind of a restart.
Yeah, a restart.
Yeah.
But like, it's a commuter campus, big, big campus, but a commuter campus, you know, even though like the Roadrunners are now like, you know, competing at Division I sports and all of that. I like, you know, Roadrunners, state bird of New Mexico, go New Mexico, right? Whippo, New Mexico, true. Also, was my high school mascot, Roadrunners.
Really? Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Temple Baptist Academy, Roadrunners, a fierce animal. But like, it is a campus in the scheme of Texas that would be like, you know, commuter school, kind of forgotten. So even just the very nature of the work, and then, you know, lots of minority students who are part of UTSA. So I just think about that for what y'all are trying to do on that campus, and the sacrificial love of loving a place that, you know, not everybody would first think, oh, I want to go be the RUF campus minister here. And then two, the sacrificial love of like, we really want to elevate Hispanic students, teach them about Jesus and the gospel, and elevate them into positions of like leading Jesus's church. Would you agree with that?
I appreciate that. It is our desire to increase leadership from all nations, and in San Antonio, you know, Hispanic leadership, Latin leadership is pivotal. It's essential here. And so, yes, that is a vision of ours, is we want to see our students flourishing and going into all four corners of the world and taking not only this culture, but being a part of other cultures and just mm-hmm. kind of sharing the beauty that they possess in their culture with other people as well. But yes, there's a lot of beauty that the Latin culture here has to offer. And we are so grateful to be a part of that and to watch these leaders grow into their own.
So thank you for that. I think we have been centering a lot of the conversation around First Peter on this idea of soft difference. So are you familiar with Wolf's little essay on First Peter about soft difference?
No.
Okay. So essentially Wolf says at one point, kind of the key line in the essay is that we, because we have this new life bursting out from within the old, we have a soft difference between us and the culture around us. So contrasting that, like a hard difference would be, I think, two like postures. So, well, three postures. So, well, wait, no, let's just say two postures. So hard difference would be, we're going to box ourselves out and separate from the world, right? That's one hard difference. The second hard difference would be, we're going to go to war with the culture. So a holy war of ideas, essentially. And that's a hard difference. And then the third wouldn't necessarily be, it would be no difference. It'd be assimilation into the culture. Now, what's interesting about that is I think that those who take a hard line difference between the Christian calling and the culture by going to war against it oftentimes mirror the culture, especially in our moment, like the unique times that we live in, and every time is unique. Like, I don't say we're unique and to set us aside as something better or harder or anything like that.
Sure.
But our form of uniqueness is that it's pretty worldly to castigate, to set up systems and postures against an opponent that doesn't hold our views.
Yeah.
It's pretty worldly to shrink our tribes based on very specific weighted measurements of who, what makes you in and what makes you out. So what's interesting about culture war is that it makes us almost like assimilate into the culture. So normally you might think about a text like this and think, oh yeah, assimilation means that you just adapt all the values of the culture and you eliminate difference altogether. Well, culture war kind of does this like hybrid thing where it fights against culture, but using the culture's means and modes and methods, right?
Uh-huh.
And becomes worldly as a result. So as you think about like that, soft difference would be something else. So what could you envision that Peter might be doing to influence us towards a soft difference? Knowing you haven't read Wolf, but some of the things we've talked to would apply, but what would you say that would look like?
Yeah, I think Peter as a character, he wrestled with this as well. We know that he had some issues earlier in his ministry with, you know,
correct
religious, you know, meat eating. And then all of a sudden he had to be rebuked with that. And then he evolved and he changed his opinions.
And then he shrinks back, right? Acts 15, he shrinks right back into, right. Yeah. And Paul has to confront him, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So Peter, even in his own life, wrestled with this, got it a little wrong, and then mm-hmm. had to grow in humility from making a mistake in this measure. I think, and
I don't want to reduce this, so I'm going to clarify what I mean by this, but I think that this is definitely an in the world and not of the world kind of situation where we want to look at all of the good things that are in culture around us, all of the things that we can see vividly pointing to God as the creator, right? All of the aspects of common grace around us. And we want to use those things to connect, right, with empathy and humanity and dignity to those around us, right? Because really, very rarely are we going to wag fingers at people and win them over with harsh arguments. That is really not going to be the winsome way that we gather people and bring them over into our tribe, if you will.
It's not the way of the kingdom, right? Like, that's not what we see presented to us very often in the New Testament.
Right, right. There is gentleness and nuance and relationship and building that happens that is going to be much more meaningful than just pointing out differences and annihilating those who disagree with you. And so I think that we can hold our beliefs and values and still offer respect and dignity to other. Now, this is where a middle school religion teacher absolutely comes into play, because I tell my students all the time, respect does not equal agreement. I can respect you. I can listen to you. I can offer you empathy and kindness and dignity without having to agree with you, right? Mm-hmm. Those are just aspects of dignifying you as a human being. And if I can listen to you and hold your views with kindness and empathy, and then later you find out that I don't fully agree with you, you're probably going to be more willing to talk to me about what we disagree on, because you know that I have held what you view in a semi-sacred way, not because I agree with it, but because I value you as a person. Mm-hmm. And so, in that line, if we can offer places where respect, safety, whatever you want to call it, where you feel valued as a person, where we can talk about things in meaningful ways, and then I can communicate what is valuable and meaningful to me, which is, you know, I see your perspective. I feel a little bit differently. Feel like God feels this way about certain things. And here's why. Because the best case scenario for human beings is this, this, and this, or whatever we want to say, right? Mm-hmm. And we say it with love and we say it with kindness, right? We can communicate really, really big truths in ways that also communicate care to people, right? It does not have to be an either or. Mm-hmm. It can be a both and. But I think when people that they are valued and cared for, while we may not agree on everything, that's going to continue conversations where harsh words and it's my way or the highway sort of behaviors will leave off. I'm not sure if that fully addresses what you're saying, but I think that's the softness and the gentleness that we're supposed to balance as we address things that we may not agree with. And of course, what we are to communicate is to be in full alignment with scripture, knowing that sometimes our interpretation could actually maybe be wrong, and we need to be humble with what we carry, no matter how right we think we are.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about this on this pod, is that just because you're convicted that you have truth, right? That what you're saying is true, what you're saying about the universe, about humanity is true, that doesn't mean that with a soft difference that you have to let go of that truth, right? It just means that you hold it with a certain level of humility and you offer it, base your the words of it in a way that is receivable, or most receivable, able to be received, And you offer those words through your life, right? And those two things go hand in hand.
Right.
And so we're engaged in the world. We care about it. So our difference doesn't preclude us from being involved and engaged. It does the opposite. It pushes us out into being engaged in the world.
Right. Yeah.
But there is still a difference. But that difference is kind of felt like a pillow instead of a rock. Like there is a gentleness that you described in the way that we hold our difference. And this is especially, I think, applicable when you think about Peter's audience and their suffering for their faith. So I want to talk about that. And then to finish, I want to kind of lead us in a different direction. But like, talk about why is the reality? So the reality, and you talked about this a little bit when you first talked about, you know, what the big kind of themes of First Peter. But why does the suffering piece of this matter? And how mm-hmm. can we like make a distinction between like everybody suffers if you're a human being? So there's mm-hmm. I've tried to be careful when I preach this book is like not to have a hierarchy of sufferings, but there is a suffering that's happening to them as a minority
mm-hmm.
people group in a Roman culture
mm-hmm.
pre-Constantine. And that has certain effects on the people. So talk to me a little bit about the theme of suffering and why that matters for the book. You have any thoughts about that?
Oh, I do. Yes. Yeah. But first, hold on, just to put a bow on the gentleness. I can't remember if I said it in the book or not, but have you heard the definition of gentleness being power restrained?
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like that is exactly what you're talking about when mm-hmm. you're talking about that soft, right? Like it's
yeah.
the power is still there. It's just bridled in a way. Okay. Yes. Suffering as a theme for First Peter. I think that this is actually a critical theme for many reasons. On one hand, it could seem funny that Peter literally, like at the get-go, names that they're suffering, right? They're these scattered exiles, yeah. right? Yeah. He like literally right then and there is like, hey, I know that you're suffering, I see you. And yet he writes them a book on like practical living.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, is that what I need
yeah,
here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, you're like, huh, does that seem like it's tone deaf or something? Is that, but I think that there's many reasons why that is. I think number one, the reality is that suffering is inescapable this side of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever kind of suffering it may be, suffering because of physical ailment, right? The suffering's because of the fall, right? Suffering outside of your control, suffering that, you know, you didn't ask for, but it's upon you. Suffering because of the consequences of your own sin, suffering that actually you did bring about because you made bad choices or you pursued wrong things. You will suffer because of those things. Suffering for righteousness' sake, which is addressed in First Peter as well. Suffering because you are following a higher ethic
mm-hmm.
than what is around you. And because the ethic around you is not as high or maybe is malaligned
mm-hmm.
With the ethic of heaven, there will be recourse. There will be consequence for having that higher ethic. There are multiple kinds of suffering. Some of it is good suffering, meaning suffering that you take on for the Lord's sake. Some of it is suffering because we are broken, right? I don't want to call it neutral because suffering is not the way it's supposed yep. to be, right? Theologically speaking, right? But it's not necessarily because of any one thing, right? And then there is suffering that is because of negative choices, right? So there's all sorts of suffering
yeah,
for
that.
All sorts of
yep.
reasons, right?
Yep.
Right. It they're suffering for all these different reasons. The point of suffering is that we cannot get out of suffering this side of heaven. Jesus did not get out of suffering this side of heaven. Mm-hmm. He endured it. And he will put an end to it one day, right? He right. is the one that is going to wipe away those tears, which right. is so beautiful. And I'm just so ready for that, right? But suffering is unavoidable. And so the lesson is not, how do I numb it? How do I minimize it? How do I pretend it doesn't exist? The lesson is, what does a God-glorifying life look like as I endure suffering? What does it look like to pursue a life that patterns after Jesus in the midst of sorrow and suffering and all of the brokenness of this world? Right. What does that look like? Yep. And Peter has an answer for that. That's what his letter is about.
Yeah, that's so good. I love that so much. And I think then from there, he does work out this, like, these household codes mm-hmm. that involve, if you're going to live this way, mm-hmm. you're going to suffer to live this way, whether it's as a servant or whether it's as a wife or a husband, or whether it's as someone in the church living their life out in the world. This week I'm preaching on, First Peter 2:11-17, mm-hmm. which has unique challenges in the sense that Peter's addressing our submission to human institutions, to emperors and empires. And so I think that has a lot of interesting things to say to us today. So help me preach my sermon on Sunday. So when you think about his call to be in submission to authority, and I want to hold this like in two ways. So how can we rightfully submit to the authorities that have been placed over us, while at the same time challenging the injustices that those institutions perpetrate?
Yeah, I think it is both, because the submission to authority is as long as it is in line with what Scripture has to say. If that makes sense, right?
It does, yep.
And so obviously our highest call is to be in submission to God and to God's will at all times. So of course, like, don't speed or recklessly drive, pay your taxes, like, do all of those things. But if a law official is carrying out something that is biblically unjust, then it's trying to use legal means to act in the interest of what is biblical, right? Act in the interest of what God would have us do. And we have examples of this in the Bible as well, right? The book of Ezra, for example, right? There are tons of examples, actually. Daniel, where when a law official does not do what the will of God is, we have examples of people disobeying the law official to carry out the will of God. No, I will not bow down to you, Darius. I am going to worship God, mm-hmm. right? I can't worship you because that is not biblical. And so it's not done in unbiblical ways, right? It's always in line with the Bible.
Right.
But our first and only allegiance is to God and his kingdom, his law, right? And when our earthly laws agree, it is time for celebration. And when our earthly laws disagree or are not in line, it's time for us to come up and to go out and to enact what the kingdom ought to look like.
And that kingdom is always marked by sacrificial love. Love that is costly to you in your very body. And that's what makes it so hard, because I mean, the challenging part of this, even if, like, you know, something's unjust, like I've encountered that so many different times in my own life where I know something that's happening unjust, but if I were to step into that situation, I know it could cost me something. It could cost me something as small as my reputation, or as large as even my own life, depending on the circumstances. And I can call to mind one or two times in my life where I feared for my life and did not step into something that was potentially wrong. Mm-hmm. And that is the call for us as the church, I think, that Peter continues to bring us back to in the book, is that our calling to obey God will involve suffering, yes, but our call to be holy, which is to love God and people, really, that's how Peter places holiness predominantly. Like, there's holiness certainly of behavior, leaving your former life, but there's this holiness that he's calling us to be, like, set apart in our love for people. And, you know, those kind of things are really challenging.
Indeed.
Sarah, do you have a favorite verse or verses from First Peter? Does one stick out to you or come to mind that you're like, oh man, I come back to that one, or that one really, I should have maybe asked you this beforehand so you could.
There are a couple. It's like, do you have a favorite child?
Yeah.
It's hard for me. There are a couple. The linchpin for me is chapter 2, verse 21, where it talks about him leaving an example. I love that one. I think that is an incredibly good one.
For those you have been called because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you examples so you might follow in their steps.
Yes, I love that one. And then another one that really speaks to me is the clothing yourself in humility. Mm-hmm. And I think of it, I think this really pertains to our conversation too. You know, Christians are to be identifiable to the world in the same way that if a police officer or like a chef were to walk out on the streets of a city, they are identifiable by their workwear, right? They're identifiable by their work uniform. Christians are to be so identifiable by their walks of holiness, by their walk of faith with Jesus. They are to be so identifiable by humility. It is to be their clothing. It is to be their outerwear. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if that were to be applied, if we as Christians were to actually do that, I think that our reputation as a church would be in a much better place than where it is right now, if we were actually clothing ourselves in humility. And then I think a third one is that be ready to spring into hospitality and into loving and serving people. I think that is just such a wonderful, positive verse. I think it shows how eager God is to love us and how our hearts are to reflect his love for his people, right? We are to reflect that to the church.
Which verse is the spring verse?
I believe it's in, is it like 4:8, something along those lines?
Yeah.
Like, let's see. I've been in Genesis with my class. And so let's see. Above all, keep offering them. Should hospitality, whatever. It's, let's see.
I love that section though.
I do too. I really all of, again, it's like, which child is your favorite? It's kind of what the Greek teaches us, I believe, in like 4:8, 4:9 there is, it's a posture of the heart.
Yeah.
That it is just to be so eager to serve that it's almost like spring loaded with tension.
Yeah. I love that. I'm going to use that. I'll give you credit. Sarah's book is A Living Hope. And you can find it on Amazon. I'll have Brian put a link in our podcast, and so people can go to that and find it. It is a good companion to be doing alongside this sermon series in First Peter. So if you're looking for something to study Redeemer alongside this, her book would be excellent to pick up and walk with. And thanks so much for being our guest today. It was good to see you.